Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Close Up Talk Radio, the unique internet broadcast series that brings you together with some of the most amazing, important, and interesting individuals from the worlds of business, industry, travel, art, and entertainment. From company owners, CEOs, and presidents, to the technical wizards behind the scenes who create the magic that make their company's products and services so special. Here is your opportunity to hear firsthand the fascinating stories of how it all happened from those who actually made it possible. This is Close Up Talk Radio. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to Close Up Talk Radio. I'm Doug Llewellyn. It's a pleasure to have you with us, and we're going to talk about law today, the law, lawyers specifically. A quick question for you. Have you ever been in need of legal representation but been confused about where to look for help? And does the idea of seeking compensation in the wake of, for example, a devastating accident seem like an impossibly daunting task? Well, you know, lawyers often come with various kinds of labels and reputations, and it can be difficult to pick a lawyer. So we thought the best way to find out how to go to pick a good lawyer and what you should look for would be to talk to a good lawyer. And that's exactly what we're going to do right now. We have a very special lady on the phone with us all the way from Berkeley, California. Her name is Susie Njigian, and she has her own law firm in Berkeley. She has been, for example, the winner of Lawyer of the Year, voted by California or named by California Lawyer Magazine in 2000 and voted to the ranks of Northern California Super Lawyers in 2005. She's been a very successful, highly respected attorney for 25 years, and her legal victories have been featured in numerous publications across the country, including the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Time Magazine. She has an extraordinary background, and we are really pleased to welcome Susie Njigian to our microphone. Susie, welcome, and good morning to you in California. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
I know it's early out there. It's high noon here on the East Coast. But, you know, it is true. People can have difficulty picking a lawyer when they need representation. It's often very confusing for them, especially in this day and age when, you know, you see advertisements on television, you hear them on radio, and you see them in the telephone book. What is your advice for someone who is seeking a lawyer? How does a lawyer like you, you know, recommend someone to find a lawyer? What do you go by?
Well, I think that the internet is a wonderful tool, and there's certainly a lot of information that you can get online, but it only goes so far. You do need to dig a little deeper and meet the lawyer personally, speak to the lawyer over the phone. I think you really want somebody who's experienced and knowledgeable in the relevant area of law. So if it's an accident case, for example, that you need a lawyer for, you want someone who is experienced in that particular type of accident. And more importantly, you want someone who's not too busy to spend time with you and your case all the way to the end, that has the ability and the desire to invest in your case and is actually excited about representing you.
Do you get excited when a good case walks in your office?
Well, I certainly do get moved by the stories I hear from people, and if I get the feeling that this is a case that I could put together under the existing law in a very compelling way that will maximize this person's compensation, yeah, I do feel like this is a case that I can really get behind, and I want to take it.
Let's talk a little bit about your law practice. Do you specialize in a specific area of the law?
I do. My background is specifically in accident law. I represent victims of mainly transportation accidents, aviation, cruise ship accidents. It really runs the gamut, but those are the two areas that I've focused on over the years.
Well, you mentioned cruise ship accidents. That sounds very interesting. I mean, aviation, we can kind of understand what that is. That's a very big area. But you're dealing there primarily with airplane crashes and the result of what happens from that. Would I be right there?
Well, that's partly true. That's how I got involved in aviation accident law. But the laws actually govern all types of incidents that can result in flight and lead to injury or death. For example, the case that I'm best known for, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court and won for the family, was involved an asthmatic doctor who was traveling with his family and had respiratory allergies as well as asthma, and he had asked to be seated away from the smoking section. This was 1998, and the airline was Olympic Airways, and smoking was still permitted on many European airlines. And the airline didn't grant his request. They sat him very close to the smoking section, and he actually suffered an asthma attack in flight and died in front of his wife and children. And this was a case that was very challenging because had it been a domestic flight, our consumer laws here, our negligence laws, would have easily given the family compensation because the airline's conduct was wrong in refusing a simple request. But because it was an international flight, it was governed by the Warsaw Convention, which gives compensation only for accidents, as accident is defined under the treaty. And that usually means plane crashes, terrorist attacks, things that go wrong with the airplane or the flight itself. And the case could have been lost because what happened to this gentleman didn't fit that definition at first glance, but I was able to successfully argue that the airline's failure to follow its own policies and honor his request, given his health condition, was indeed an accident within the definition in the treaty, and that actually changed the law for everybody going forward.
Wow. And where did that case go to trial?
That case went to trial in San Francisco in federal court, and we won, and the airline appealed it to the Ninth Circuit, and then we won there, and then appealed it to the Supreme Court, and the decision to affirm it was handed down in 2004.
Wow. Well, that's a very interesting case. Obviously, things have changed in that area then, thanks to you and following up on that case. What about cruise ship accidents? What kinds of things are we talking there? You don't hear a lot about cruise ship accidents, you know. There's not a lot of them, but there's stuff that goes on while you're on the ship, right?
There are all kinds of things that happen while you're on the ship. Cruise ships have become sort of cities on the sea, and you live on a cruise ship for any length of time. I mean, it could be a few days, it could be actually years. It's a very interesting industry. And so accidents happen aboard cruise ships, and the challenge there that most people don't know about is the law that applies is not, again, the consumer law that we have here on land that looks out for consumers and their rights to be safe from harm. The law that applies to cruise ships is maritime law. And maritime law developed in the 17th and 18th centuries and is very favorable to ship owners because ship owners were in a very high-stakes, high-risk business. They faced things like piracy and bad weather, and they could, you know, lose an entire ship very, very easily through no fault of their own. And those laws that developed over 100 years ago are actually being used now to prevent victims of injury aboard cruise ships from getting any compensation. That can be very surprising to people who get off a cruise ship and they believe they have certain rights, and actually the law says they don't. So that's an area that I enjoy working in because it allows me to go into court and argue that these laws need to be modernized to fit the current practice of how ships are being used for entertainment, vacation, for entire families.
Does the case depend on where that ship is registered, whether it's a Greek ship line or a French ship line or some other a ship line other than a U.S. line?
Yes, it can. There are many complicated factors that courts will look at, but I would say that the most important factor is whether the cruise itinerary touches a U.S. port at any time, whether it embarks from a U.S. port or arrives in a U.S. port or calls at a U.S. port. That's going to determine whether you have more of the more recent U.S. laws applying to protect the passenger.
And what are the typical kinds of cases that you handle that involve cruise ships? Again, we hear about people getting sick, on cruise ships. Sometimes people die from illness on cruise ships, and then you have cases where people fall overboard. But I can't recall seeing a lot in the media, at least, about just minor accidents or accidents on cruise ships. So what do you deal with?
Well, you don't see a lot in the media, in part because when cases settle, there is usually a confidentiality provision that prevents the passenger and the passenger's attorney from discussing the case or the settlement amount. But I can tell you that there are many injury cases arising from cruise ships. These are very big enterprises. The industry is growing in leaps and bounds. They're very popular vacations because you can go three generations, grandparents, parents, children. You pretty much know where everybody is at all times within the confines of the ship. And so, and the prices are good. They're really quite reasonable.
I know.
But you're basically in a place where you're out at sea and you're being taken care of by a sizable crew. Oftentimes, these are recent hires. They haven't always had the training that you might anticipate that they would have, and things can go wrong. I've actually had cases ranging from bad medical care, very bad medical care, and compensation for such cases is very, very limited and very challenging. Two cases involving an elderly woman being transported down a gangplank on a wheelchair, and the young man working for the cruise line let go of the wheelchair. He lost his balance, and she just went flying down. So there's all sorts of things that can happen. And they seem to be straightforward cases, but because it's maritime law, they are not.
And when accidents like that happen, like the wheelchair accident, I mean, I can understand, I guess everybody can, the cruise lines wanting to keep the news about these kinds of accidents quiet, not get media exposure, and go for those confidentiality clauses. But aren't they willing to kind of take care of a situation like that, a wheelchair accident, or do they hold out and force you to go to court against them for the most part?
For the most part, they hold out, and that is because there are many defenses available to them, and their attorneys doing their job for their client, the cruise line, really want to make sure that they're not giving money away. They don't believe that they're doing anything wrong by invoking these defenses. It's a system, and there are ways that they can escape liability, and if they can, they will. As far as they're concerned, their freedom for liability for the sorts of things they would be responsible for on land is what figures into the very economical cruise ship ticket prices, and they will say that, well, this is the trade-off. If you get injured, then you have to take care of yourself. That's part of the package of a cheap cruise vacation.
Yeah, wow. Well, you're in a very interesting area of the law, and I assume you handle other cases as well, but, I mean, you are kind of known for these aviation and cruise ship situations.
I would say I'm more known for the aviation cases because that's where I've been able to affect the law going forward for other passengers. There have been other cases like the Olympic Airways case that did establish new law expanding passengers' rights. So I would say that that's really where my reputation grew. The cruise ship cases I have been doing more recently, they kind of came to me by word of mouth, and then the more you do them, the more you end up getting cases referred to you because you're just known to have the specialization developed, and so that's something that I'm doing more of these days.
Now, I know you're in Berkeley in California. You're in the, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Are the people you represent, are they mostly from that area, or do you handle cases from people all over the country?
I handle cases from people all over the country. That's what I started doing when I was a young attorney at Stearns & Walker, where I worked for 14 years. And that was a boutique firm, a boutique aviation firm, meaning a small firm, just a few lawyers, handling very big cases. And whenever there was a big plane crash, and there were in the 90s, quite a few across the country, we ended up representing victims from those plane crashes. And I would fly all over the country to appear in court and attend court proceedings on these cases. And so it's just something that I've continued to do since I've gone out on my own. Cruise ships often require in the ticket, in the fine print of the ticket, that if you're going to sue them, you've got to sue them in Miami. So I will, from time to time, file lawsuits in Miami and work them up there. And, you know, Los Angeles is a very common venue for cases that I handle. I like them to be close to home, but that's not always the case.
Yeah. Is there an advantage for them to have those cases tried in Miami, which would be under Florida law, I presume?
Well, it's under Florida law to some extent, but maritime law is federal, and it governs all over the country. So whatever court you're in, you're going to be limited by maritime law, and also your rights are going to be defined by maritime law. So that doesn't make too much of a difference. It's for the cruise line's convenience, and they are permitted to require that the case be brought against them in Miami or Los Angeles, wherever they want it to be. It's usually Miami. So I guess they perceive some advantage there. They're favorite lawyers are local and tend to have all their cases centered in one court. So, yeah, I guess it's an advantage to them. I don't perceive it as a disadvantage for my clients. It can be a little more expensive, but it's actually a good thing to have judges who see these cases over and over again. They're going to be more familiar with the case law.
Yeah. You know, I noticed one thing. I mean, you're talking about cases that can be very lengthy in time, and consequently very expensive to take to court, to take to trial. But I noticed that your fees are primarily contingency fee based. Some people may not know what that means. Define that for me, please.
Yes, my fees are purely contingent fee, which means that I don't take any money from my clients' pockets at all. I get paid only when I obtain a recovery in settlement or at trial for my client, and then it is a percentage of the client's recovery. And separate from what I get paid for my time and effort is the cost of the litigation, which can run up to tens of thousands of dollars, in some cases over $100,000 to take a case to trial. And that is for things like court fees and evidence gathering and deposition taking and expert witnesses. They are very, very expensive. Often you have to hire doctors and engineers and other types of economists, other types of experts who charge a pretty penny for their time, as they should. They're very, very qualified, and their testimony can be very persuasive and necessary to a case. But that really does grow the litigation cost bill, and clients, regular people, can't afford to pay that as the case is progressing. And so I will invest in my case. I will advance those sums and pay myself back if and when there is a recovery out of the client's recovery. If there is no recovery, which can happen in a very challenging case, I bear the loss completely.
Well, that's obviously you pay close attention to the cases that you decide to take, because it would seem to me if you didn't think there was a pretty good possibility that you could prevail, you know, you probably wouldn't take the case. At least that would be my guess. Am I right?
Oh, Well, that's a very good guess, Doug, and I think that that's something that often gets overlooked when people think about trial lawyers, contingent fee lawyers, injury lawyers as proceeding with frivolous lawsuits. We have a very strong disincentive to take a frivolous lawsuit because we're putting our own time and money on the line. I'm not alone in this. I think that certainly there are many varying policies for fees and costs. Many lawyers who operate on a contingent fee basis do take costs from the clients up front. I don't do that. Some will ask for reimbursement if the case does not succeed. I don't do that. But I think that for the class of lawyers that I sort of represent, it's an important thing to remember. We wouldn't take a frivolous lawsuit because we would end up losing quite a bit ourselves.
No question about that. You know, you have a fascinating background. I'm just do you still enjoy? You've been practicing. How long have you been practicing now?
Oh gosh, over 25 years, 26 years now.
I was just going to ask you. I mean, you're in a really fascinating area of the law. Do you enjoy it as much now as you did in the very beginning?
I think I enjoy it more. It's certainly more rewarding when you know more and you have a lot more experience and you know exactly what to do. It's just like anything else. The better you get at something, the more you enjoy it. And I've had the great good fortune of working with some real stars in the field. My former employer and mentor, Gerald Stearns, was an absolute legend in aviation accident law, and I learned a great deal from him. And now that I have my own firm, which I've operated for the past 7 years, I don't need the mentoring. I like to mentor other young lawyers, and I just really enjoy what I'm doing.
You were named Lawyer of the Year by California Magazine back in 2000. I mean, that was obviously quite an honor for you to have that bestowed upon you. What did you do to get that?
Well, that was actually the first stage of the Olympic Airways case before it ever went to the Supreme Court and before anybody really understood the impact it had on international air travel with respect to the definitions of the Warsaw Convention. It was originally lauded as the largest, historically the largest secondhand smoking verdict in a case. It was seen as a secondhand smoking verdict, which it was, but of course my focus was much more on the legal hurdle to recovery, which was the Warsaw Convention. And the case ultimately became known for its impact on the Warsaw Convention. And because that's an international treaty, the impact is not just within our country. It's in every country that is a signatory to the Warsaw Convention, which is really very gratifying to know that you've had that sort of impact. But when the case first was tried, it was a secondhand smoke case, and that's how the media saw it, and it was California Lawyer Magazine that gave me the honor for that reason.
And explain to me what super lawyer means. You are a super lawyer in California. What does one do to get that, you know, that credit to their background?
Well, there's a publication called Law and Politics Magazine that established this particular institution called Super Lawyers, and they don't exist in all cities, but they do exist in the major cities and I guess geographic locations. So I am a Northern California super lawyer, and that means that the Law and Politics Magazine, they set up a blue ribbon panel of lawyers and judges who took nominations and did this vetting process and voted to determine who would be in the top 5% in this particular geographic location, Northern California. So I fell into that top 5%, and that's why I was named a super lawyer.
Well, that's really terrific. Your firm now, you say it's your own firm. Do you have is it just you, or do you have a lot of lawyers with you as well?
Oh, it is just me, although when I do take cases out of state, I do have to associate local counsel for convenience and because the courts almost always require a member of their own bar sponsor an out-of-state lawyer to practice in the court. So I do associate other lawyers. I do hire people as a case requires, and that, again, is at my expense. But I do run my shop by myself. I like to select my own cases. I like to manage them, and I've been doing that successfully now for about 7 years.
That's very interesting. Let me ask you some tips here. What makes you decide to take on a case? Suppose someone is interested in contacting you. They think they have a legitimate dispute in a case. What's the process? What do you do?
Well, because cases are very expensive and time-consuming, I am very, very selective. And the criteria, I don't know that I can really boil it down to a list, but I can tell you that it's got to be a compelling case, and that usually means the loss, the damage, is quite great. It's not something that anybody is going to overcome very easily. A death case, for example, which is the ultimate loss, and then there's some terrible injury cases that are life-altering. And so, a compelling set of facts. And then I want to look at how wrongful was the conduct that caused this damage, and whether or not the law provides a remedy. And oftentimes, if there appears to be a remedy under the law, but it hasn't been tried before, or it's not obvious, or there is a real risk that the case could be dismissed, I'm actually more excited about that kind of case, because that's the kind of case where I'm able to make a difference for people beyond my my one client. And it's more rewarding for me, and it's more rewarding for the client. And the case, the success tends to be a bigger success monetarily for the client as well in those situations.
Yeah. And these cases can often take a long time, can't they? I mean, they aren't quick.
No, they aren't quick. They, I think class actions are a lot slower, so people who get involved in those can really be sitting around waiting for, years, up to 10 years or longer. Personal injury death cases, they can settle within a matter of months, or they can take, if they go through appeals, they can be tied up in court for about 5 years.
Do you find that most of the cases, or let me just ask you, of the cases you take on, when you file the case, do you find that the defendant is willing to settle out of court and not go through the process of a trial, or do they go through the whole thing?
Well, the statistics are that 95% of civil litigation ends in settlement rather than trial, and there are very real reasons for that. Nobody wants to take the risks when they get up to trial because it is quite a gamble. I believe in the jury system, and I think it is the greatest system in the world. However, it is fraught with risk, and one of the things that we as lawyers do for our clients on both sides is manage risk. So that's why you see that 95% of cases settle, and, of course, my record is pretty much the same. I would also say, however, that there is no quick decision by defendants to settle a case. They want to see what your lawyer can do at trial. They want to see what that risk is really going to look like at trial. They want to see what the evidence is. They want to meet the clients. They want to try various defenses, try to get the case dismissed if they can through loopholes and exceptions and things like that. And they want to see what they're up against. They want to see if your lawyer is going to spend the money it takes to win a trial. And after they see all of that, they can assess their risk better and evaluate what they're willing to pay.
Yeah, so they put you through the mill, right?
They do.
Yeah. Susie, you have been fascinating to talk to. The time has just been flying by. I want to thank you so much for your time. And let me just, you have a very interesting website. Let me spell this out. It's www.injijianlaw.com. Again, it's injijianlaw.com. Susie Injigian, and her law firm in Berkeley, California. Susie, thank you for your time. This has been most interesting. I really appreciate your spending it with us, okay?
The pleasure was all mine, Doug. Thank you.
You are very, very welcome. And there you are, folks, some very fascinating information on the subject of law that you probably didn't know from a very, very expert attorney. I'm Doug Llewellyn. Thanks for being with us. See you next time right here on Close Up Radio. Bye for now.